Welcome to Court and Controversy. I'm Janine Yunus. On this program, I'll be discussing a wide variety of controversial topics with some of the most original thinkers of our time, and no holds barred. I bring a litigator's perspective, and my guests will come from different backgrounds and industries. Enjoy the show. My guest today is Melissa Witte. She caught my attention on Twitter because she has a lot of very interesting views that you wouldn't necessarily expect to belong to the same person. I think she can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think she'd describe herself as a Republican, Southern Christian, but she is very pro-Palestine. She's extremely critical of the United States' support for Israel and a lot of our campaign finance laws, or maybe not laws, but a lot of the campaign finance issues that allow the U.S. to provide excessive support to Israel. So I thought I'd have her on today to discuss that and also other political issues. There's a lot going on in the country right now. We have an election coming up. Trump just decided on J.D. Vance as his vice president, which has been a bit of a controversial pick. So we'll talk about that. Joe Biden just decided to withdraw from the presidential race. So apparently Kamala Harris is the nominee, although I guess it's not 100%, but probably. So we'll talk about that as well, and a lot of other interesting things. So thank you so much for joining me today, Melissa.
Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about your background, like where you grew up, your educational background, and your political views?
Yeah, so I'm technically an Army brat, but for almost all my life, I've lived here in Fayetteville, North Carolina, which is right next to Fort Bragg, now Fort Liberty. As you know, I'm sure maybe some people know that it changed, but my dad was in the Army for 27 years. I was married to a Green Beret who is also retired. We were married for 10 years, and then and my boyfriend now is I'm divorced, and then I have a boyfriend who he is retired Army as well. So I've been around the military my entire life. And yeah, I was, you know, kind of raised in a very patriotic, conservative home, wonderful parents, wonderful upbringing. And, you know, Israel was kind of one of those things that it was just a given. It wasn't ever like talked about like a bunch in my house, but you know, so yeah, I think most people kind of assume that somebody like me, being conservative, you know, white woman, from the South, I think, again, that's just kind of a given. And I just take a different approach to it. And usually, I've been pleasantly surprised, especially in recent years, that I can typically get people to at least concede that I make good points.
That's good. Yeah. I mean, it's funny because your bio on Twitter, I forgot exactly what order you say things, but something like, you know, Southern Christian, patriot. And it's just very, I have to admit, as much as I try not to judge people or make assumptions, it's hard for me to have pro-Palestinian go with that. I mean, I have some issues with the term pro-Palestinian because I think it's simplistic. But just for the sake of the ease of listeners, you know, let's say that's more or less your view. It's just really rare to see that confluence of characteristics in one person. So I thought it was very interesting. And before we get into that, can you talk a little bit about your families and your ex-husband's experience in the military and how that shaped some of your views, not necessarily about Palestine, but the Middle East, our wars in the Middle East, especially?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, you know, my dad deployed to Desert Storm. We went to Kuwait. You know, it's kind of funny because yeah, everything changed after 9/11, right? But during, you know, during Desert Storm, I specifically remember him bringing us home or sending us home like burkas, like, well, not like a full burka, but you know, it was like the face covering and then the head covering. And we used to wear, it was so exotic to us, you know? My mom had that in her hope chest that she sang, that my dad sent to me and my sister for years. And you know, yeah, it's so funny when I think about it now, because like, that would never happen. Like nobody's sending their children, you know, if they get deployed or whatnot. But so that was kind of my upbringing. My dad went to Desert Storm. Obviously 9/11 happened when I was in 10th grade. I watched it I don't want to say, radicalized, but obviously like very gung-ho. We have to go get them. I can't believe
Oh.
us, kind of thing. And not really co understanding the complexities and whatnot. I'm very torn on Afghanistan. I don't believe in nation building, but I do believe there obviously has to be consequences when you attack. So that's kind of a really long conversation in and of itself. But then Iraq happened, and that happened when I was a junior in high school, or no, I guess I must have been a senior when we invaded.
It was
Something.
2003, yeah, something like that. You're a couple of years younger than me, so I think you were probably a junior.
It was 2003, so I was a senior, so I can still remember seeing, watching it. I was at work when, Bush addressed the country and whatnot. And again, living in a military town, I worked at a Texas Roadhouse, and anybody who's ever been to Fayetteville, North Carolina knows that, like, this Texas Roadhouse, it was like we just used to have all these guys, all these Joes come in all the time. So I was always like around these guys, and I remember seeing them off, or seeing, regulars come in and then they would leave. And obviously being very pro our troops, we have to support them. We cannot trash this war because we have to support them. And really being young and not understanding that that's actually not the best way to support them. The best way is to always demand that we never put their lives on the line.
Right. So when did you change your mind about Iraq?
It was unfortunately much, much later. I hate to say that. I'm embarrassed. I mean, I was really young, but 2010. So let me see. I met my first husband in 2007. He had been a Green Beret already. He had already been on a tour to Iraq. In his first tour, 2005, they were hit by an IED, and
Oh, wow.
he so two of his teammates, and if you know anything about SF teams, they're very small, they're very close-knit. They were killed, but his kind of his mentor, Brett, was killed, and that left like a scar on him, and I met him 2 years after that happened. But then just kind of like meeting Brett's wife, talking to her and getting to know her, and then their daughter, it kind of gave me a different feel, like, why are we here? You see, when you see the sacrifice up close in real life. And then I had a very good girlfriend whose husband was killed, and I was on my way to her house when the note came to the door. So I was there as she's breaking down, freaking out, and that was hard. That was really hard, just seeing the impact and being, why? Like, what are we even doing? And
Did that lead you to be more critical of war in general, or did you think Iraq was sort of an exception?
no, that left me to be very critical of war. Well, actually, I take that back. And initially, it was just Iraq. And then, over time, you've got Syria, you've got Libya. What happened in Libya was just horrific. Not just to what happened to the embassy, but I genuinely thought it was shameful what happened to Gaddafi. No matter what they said that he did, I just feel like we don't act like that. We don't support people who sodomize someone to death with a machete. Like, this is barbaric.
Yeah, and we have more sort of similar instances of that in the recent, the last week or so. Well, at least that we've known about in the last week or so in Israel, but we can get to that in a bit. So, what led you to your, I presume, among your friends and family, unique views on Israel?
So when I was married, we were my ex-husband went from being an 18 Delta, which is a Green Beret, like a medic on a Green Beret team, and then he decided to switch over and become a PA, which is a 55 Delta. So he had to go to school, And so we
Is
went.
that, sorry to interrupt, is that a physician's assistant, you mean?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
And so he had to go to school in Texas. So I moved. We moved from we were living at Clark in Clarksville at the time, Clarksville, Tennessee, down to Texas, and we lived there for about 18 months. And there I went to UTSA. I'm a political science major, and I had a professor. He was a Jewish man, and it's funny. I was telling you before the show, but like, just being from the South, there's just not very many Jewish people here, period. I live in a county of, I looked it up a couple of days ago, it was like 350,000. In my city, there's about 200,000 people. We have one Jewish temple.
Wow.
We have in the county like something like 160 Baptist churches.
That's quite a
So
contrast.
the juxtaposition is just, like when I say I don't know any Jewish people, it's so funny because there's so many things like names and whatnot, like, oh, that's a typical Jewish name. I don't know anything about Jewish culture, Jewish customs, Jewish traditions, nothing like that. So I don't have any like, normal like prejudice that you might have with people that you interact with, because I've never done it. So it was funny because he was kind of like the first person that I'd ever met that he was Jewish. And of course, I just assume he's for Israel, and this is not something that I ever really talk about. And then he turns out to be this really hardcore anti-Zionist.
Oh, wow.
And a lot of our this was a geopolitical class, it was a political geography class, and he was really, I mean, his lectures, he would go on, sometimes the full hour lecture would be just about the conflict and really kind of introducing us. And I'm loud. I like to push back, and he put me in my place several times about settlers and land grabs, because I was repeating same old talking points. I've always been told that, Palestinians are the ones they're the ones who break all the peace deals. They're the ones who won't accept peace. What are they supposed to, what are Israelis supposed to do? Yada, yada, yada. And no, he did not ever let any of that slide. And he was sometimes not very kind about it. But it's good now. It's funny because now that I've even just been through the ringer just a little bit on Twitter, I understand you actually do lose patience pretty quickly with people who tell you the same thing over and over and over again, and clearly just have no idea what they're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. So what, I mean, what would you say you kind of, what would you say was your realization about it, and how has that shaped your views about politics in the United States?
So I don't think that it was like, oh, like, like a what an aha moment. It was just a learning thing. So like that was back in 2010. And so that's kind of when the Gaza flotilla thing was going off. And that was the first time I learned about the blockade. And I'm like, okay, well, this is wrong. Like, what do you mean you're not gonna let you have a list of like 300 things that are allowed in? What do you mean you won't let concrete come back in? What do you mean you won't let this basic medicines in? So that's wrong, obviously. And I think most people, when you break it down very simple like that, they would agree, like, no, okay, that's unrealistic. That shouldn't be expected. But I think the problem is for most people is that it's easy to kind of dismiss. It's far away. We don't think about it, right? I get it. It wasn't until I really started in my final year in college, started looking into lobbying and the money in politics, that I started to really kind of say, hold up, this is the Israeli lobby has kind of a ridiculous amount of influence. And I actually wasn't aware. I don't think most people, I think even people who thought it was bad, weren't quite aware how significant the influence is until this latest event. And that was when I started to get really turned off at the way, because my issue is like I'm a partisan, I'm a Republican, obviously, and AIPAC is not partisan. AIPAC is, and so I see, my Republican politicians going hardcore for Israel, and I'm like, But their lobby is pushing for progressives. Their lobby is getting, it's helping getting people who are ideologically, demonic sometimes, in my opinion, is helping getting them elected just because they're saying the right things on Israel. Like, I have a real problem with you all aligning with these, with this lobby and pushing them so hard.
Yeah, I mean, both parties really, as you've identified, are heavily influenced by the Israel lobby, especially AIPAC, but also other groups. I mean, now, the right is kind of acting as though the left is this pro-Hamas, pro-Palestinian party, which is completely ridiculous because in practice, the two really are not very different. I think over the last couple years, the left has come to say some nicer things, or left-leaning politicians, they'll say nicer things, but they don't actually do anything. I mean, Biden, for all of his talk, has not done anything, I think, necessarily different than Trump would do. But why do you think that the Republicans are, given, this sort of more patriotic America first motto that they have, it's almost stranger that they are so beholden to Israel and they're willing to look out for Israel's interests above our own. I mean, as you and I were saying before this, I think that it's pretty clear that our unequivocal support for Israel actually makes us less safe, despite what people say. And despite what people say, the Arab world does not hate us because we're free. They don't hate us for our freedom. They don't hate us because there are a lot of Jews who live here. They hate us because have had a lot of territorial acquisition in their land. And then also because we've unequivocally supported Israel to the detriment of the Palestinians. Having family from that region, I can tell you that that's why people don't like Israel. Sorry, that's why people don't like the United States. So I think this makes us far less safe. I mean, you really think that the lobby is so strong that it's overriding Republican politicians' ability to look out for our citizens' interests?
Yes, and something that's kind of a little confounding, I think, when you look at when you if you just look at just the AIPAC numbers, and when I say AIPAC, I'm talking about their entire umbrella network, which includes more PACs than just AIPAC.
Right, yeah.
When I say AIPAC, that's kind of like a that's the pro-Israel lobby, essentially.
Right.
But if you look at their numbers, the money is not split even. Republicans are they're actually pretty cheap dates as far as Israel is concerned. Democrats get about two-thirds, 66% of the money, and then Republicans get a third. And this is consistent pretty much every year. It costs a lot more money to buy off the Democrats. Don't get me wrong, they do it very successfully.
So, is there an argument that the pro-Israel lobby doesn't have to spend as much on Republicans because they would be more inclined to take Israel's side anyway?
Yes. So there is definitely a religious and a tradition attached to Republican support for Israel. Absolutely. There is, somebody wrote a great thread, and I can't remember who it was at the very beginning of this, and it actually explained a lot of it to me. They talked about, kind of conservative boomers, how so much of their idea of America and what America stands for is really, really wrapped up in World War II. And they see that as kind of like the pinnacle accomplishment, right? That was the height of Americana. We rescued Europe, but we rescued the Jews. We defeated the ultimate evil. And so a lot of their sentiment in America is wrapped up in the survival of the Jewish people. And so they really project a lot of that. And I see that in my own family. I see that in people that I talk to. At the end of the day, when it's all said and done, when they cannot argue with me anymore, they will always revert to the Jews have just been through so much. Just let them have the land.
Wow.
And it's very, and I'm like, okay, but the thing is that The Palestinians didn't have anything to do with that. Like, and I, if somebody came to me and said, "Hey, give your house to these Jews because they've been through so much," I know exactly what I would tell them, and I know exactly what you would tell them if it were you too. So I think it's really easy. But again, this is very far away. This is not, it's not something that anybody has to think about on a regular basis. So it's a very easy default position. But because conservative, the base is it really is heavy on the boomer end. You see that, and that's kind of like the default.
So, have you noticed a difference among younger people? I don't know, people our age, people even younger than that. Do you think there's a change that's happening on that level?
Oh, yes. I don't want to say there's like maybe ne not necessarily like me. I don't want to say I'm like a bleeding heart, but I really empathize with the Palestinian cause because I just kind of think like if this happened to me, I know that I would not give up. I would not. I would be just as stubborn, just as dug in, heels in the dirt, fight to the death, kind of, because that's just my personality. I'm very patriotic. I'm very and that's something that I don't understand about conservatives sometimes. I'm like, you guys are all like, don't tread on me. So try that in a small town. And then you just expect these people to lay down and take it. I'm like, give me a break. If the government was doing this to you all would be freaking strapped too. I mean, I say it all the time. Like if the government had done to me what Israel had done to these people, I can tell you, it just I actually think that we would give the resistance a run for their money as far as what our response would be. We are not the kind of people that just lay down and take it. That's
And
I know.
this isn't even a government that they remotely elected. It's an occupying force. They're not allowed to have their own government. So it's even, I mean, it's arguably much worse.
Right. Yeah. And so that's what I just and I've cornered so many people on this and they'll either give me some kind of half-assed answer or they'll but I've had a couple people say, I mean, you're right, but so they get it deep down. And then usually with those people that say that you're right, they just kind of back off. They don't say anything. But I have found, I've tried many, many different ways. I've not been very kind to some people. I've lost my cool many times. I don't drink and post anymore.
There are a couple on the Zionist side who clearly do drink and tweet. I've gotten some very bizarre accusations. I'm like, I have no idea what you're talking about. You just.
I just go full BITCH mode and I am mean
Well,
and
you're very sharp. And then another thing I really like about you that I've noticed is that you are very willing to change your mind and admit it, which not so many people on Twitter are willing to do. So I've noticed that and come to appreciate it.
I mean, I try not to dig in too hard as far as especially like if it's like a facts thing, just accept it, move on. It's not that big of a deal. I don't know. There's a lot of time wasted defending bad positions. Try not to do that, but
So to get back to my initial question, do you see hope among the younger people? Because I cling to that. I really, really want to see something happen for the Palestinian people before my father dies. He's like 73. It's his dream is to see his family get some rights and have a state, or at least have equal rights in Israel. So I keep on hoping that something will change. I've been hoping for a few decades now. But yeah, I was wondering what your take is, since you clearly know a lot more people on the Republican side than I do.
so, I mean, obviously, the boomers, my biggest worry is there's going to be some kind of false flag because that's all it's going to take for them.
Someone else just said this to me the other day.
That is my biggest worry. You notice kind of a pattern with some of these attacks, how they take place. I try to watch my wording on that because, I personally don't believe that October 7th happened by accident. I don't believe it was nearly as, but I know that there's a lot of people that take a lot of I don't want to say pride, but they think like these are real resistance fighters. They really did do this, and I don't want to necessarily like take away from that per se. And I know there's a lot of, I know I'm probably already stepping in it right now, even saying anything like that, because I know what everybody's gonna say. You can save it. I already know what you're gonna say. And
But do you condemn October 7th? That's the question. I'm
terrible thing.
joking.
I'm like, terrible things did happen, and my heart breaks for the people who actually had to go through all of those things. On an individual level, obviously nobody deserves anything like that. But there is a bigger picture, and considering what has happened transpired in the 10 months after, it's really hard to still get worked up about that. It was hard to get worked up 10 days afterwards. Seeing what has happened, we've seen a lot of the accusations get totally debunked. Things that happened, some of the stuff is just so outrageous. Somebody linked me to an article the other day that was from very early on. I couldn't believe it was still up, and it was Netanyahu saying that they had gathered up children and wrapped them in cord and then doused them in gasoline and lit them on fire. Like just a blatant lie, like a total fabrication. I was just like, I can't believe this is still up. This was like 2 days ago,
I mean, so much of this has been debunked, and it was clearly just touted in order to justify what they knew were going to be horrendous atrocities in Gaza, including, I mean, most of us who know what's going on knew months ago that there was terrible torture going on at that Sdeh Tayyem. I don't know how to pronounce it, but there had been numerous international reports, but of course they were ignored for the most part, and it was only when three whistleblowers came forward and reported on the horrendous atrocities that were taking place there, including raping a detainee with a metal pole until his insides basically fell out, and handcuffing somebody so severely that his hands had to be amputated. Just horrible things. And these are detainees. They have not been charged, let alone convicted of anything. And many of these people turned out to have nothing to do with Hamas or any kind of militancy. They were totally innocent. And ironically, the nine of the soldiers who were apparently involved in this were arrested. And Israelis rioted, not because of what had happened to the Palestinian prisoners, but because of these people had been arrested. And all these people on Twitter are saying, they're innocent until proven guilty, innocent until proven guilty. Okay, all good enough, but you're the same people who are saying that all the Palestinians who are at this camp must be Hamas terrorists and deserve to die. So it's just such hypocrisy. It's unbelievable.
Right. That reading through, and I do, I'm like your classic woman, right? I get all hyper emotional and worked up. I do. I'm like to a T, walking around yelling. And so there were some images early on that really stuck with me. The one that I said I can't do this anymore was the little girl on Super Bowl Sunday, the one that she had her legs blown off and she was thrown against the wall. And so I don't so I try to filter all of that stuff, so I never look at it anymore. I can't, because I could feel myself, it's not good. It's not I can't even imagine what the people go through living there, because I can't even handle it in my house. I want to drink all the time because I'm like looking at these terrible images, and there's nothing I can do. So I can't even imagine seeing that in real life. But so that story out of the prison was the first really kind of graphic thing that I had read since Super Bowl, for the most part. I mean, there were a couple other things, and it was so horrific and so disturbing, knowing that my tax dollars, my country is directly subsidizing the most everything that you've ever accused Hamas of. This is it. At the very best, you are no different than what you say they are. at the very best. And at the very worst, you are a thousand times worse because everything you've said that they do has been debunked thus far. So, and you know, so I'm like, it was so disturbing. And I actually confided in my sister, who she and I have disagreed vehemently on this. And she was really, really bothered by this. And she was angry. This was the first time that I saw her really angry about what is going on. You know, I sent her the articles. She was furious. And so, you know, just seeing them riot for these people. I was actually shocked that they sent somebody to arrest the soldiers to begin with.
They were under such international pressure, I think they knew they had to, or but
It's wild because you don't even hear anything in the US. It's
I
so
know.
crazy, you
Yeah.
know?
I
And I
know.
mean, if this were Putin, we would be invading.
Right.
We would be invading.
And here, so I mean, that brings me to my next question, which is, I'm sure you get asked this. I have less of a problem with this question. But why do you care? Why do you care so much about Israel and Palestine? There are atrocities going on all the time. There's Boko Haram, there, this and that. And I have an easy answer. My family's there. So people don't ask me that question as much, but I'm sure you get asked that question. And what is your response?
Sometimes the reason why I kind of get really passionate about it is, you know, I don't think about it too. Obviously, the US is directly subsidizing all of this. It's not just that, like, oh, we support Israel. It's that we're literally sending the cargo planes full of bombs every single day. We're the ones, number one. Number two, and I said this from the very get-go, is that Israel after 10/7 was blinded by revenge, and they were going to bite off more than they can chew. I could just sense it. I could feel it in my bones. I'm very aware of the geopolitical situation. I have a minor in geography. Like I love geography. I know it very well. I know all about you know, the Iranian proxies all around. I'm well versed in it, so I knew the challenges that they were already going to face. And then some of it, maybe it's ego, maybe it's you know, just personal rebellion at the thought that, like, I'm supposed to support Israel, you know. And yeah, because everybody thinks it's just a given, and I'm like, no. And I'm actually going to tell you that here's, you know, if you want to listen, I'll tell you.
Well, also, like, because our government is funding it and we veto all these, UN resolutions and things that could potentially put some pressure on Israel to change the circumstances, because we're responsible for that, our protesting can actually change it. I mean, I don't necessarily mean you're going to protest in the
Absolutely.
streets, but our, yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to cut you off. But you're 100% right. But there's also something else. You know, I'm acutely aware of kind of, well, number one, I'm very well aware of the way that the US military conducts itself in the middle, you know, conducts itself in wartime. And no, we are not perfect by any means. Obviously, you know, horrific things happened in Iraq. It was an unjust war, it was an unjust invasion. And I don't defend it at all, whatsoever. But I do know, having been married to a Green Beret, having, you know, dated my boyfriend, we are common law married, I guess. Our soldiers don't treat people like that. They just don't. Like, you know, when Abu Ghraib happened, that was a big deal. I remember feeling a deep shame about that. I was just disgusted by those soldiers and the way that they acted. And I'm not saying that it doesn't happen. It absolutely does. And when you put men in war, terrible things are going to happen. It just, you know, whether it's Mylae, whether it's the Nova Festival, whether it is Abu Ghraib. But it's different, obviously, when you have these bursts, and then you have accountability. And then when you have what seems to be a sanctioned policy of anything goes, and you know, and this is This is our government directly subsidizing, but not just that. This is our government telling me that we have to support them unconditionally and we'll stand by them no matter what, and giving 58 standing ovations to.
And not to mention, I mean, they call themselves the most moral army in the world. So while
Yeah.
they're posting photos on social media of all the atrocious things that they're doing to Palestinians and their property, so that makes it all the more outrageous to me.
Having been through, excuse me, four combat deployments, my husband never sent me anything. Like, that's just bizarre. That would have been like, what the hell? Something else interesting, what my ex-husband, when he was deployed, he used to, I used to think, I think about this sometimes. They would, being a team, being an SF team, they would live in these towns. They didn't actually live on the bases. They would be buried in with the locals. Now we call those human shields. But when the U.S. military is doing it, apparently it's totally fine. They used to have a maid. They used to have, and they used to dress like the locals. They never wore the SF guys. They never wore. They didn't wear their freaking fatigues over there or anything like that. I have like tons of pictures, or I used to anyways, of him in like the long garb and everything like that, full beard. And so it's just, whenever I hear like, oh, they bury themselves with the civilian population, so I'm like, yeah, well, we did too. So I don't know what you're talking about. It's always different, obviously, of course, our side. I mean, whatever. It's just, I see the double standard at all times, and it drives me insane. And if we weren't supporting them, I probably would still think that this was awful. But the thing is that if the US wasn't supporting Israel, this would have ended a long, long time ago. They went to the bombs like the second week.
That's absolutely true. Why do you think you're able to see this, the double standard and the hypocrisy and all of this, and a lot of people around you are not?
I always say it's because I'm a Gemini.
Surely there are a lot of Geminis in North Carolina, though. Do you
always say
attribute
that.
it? Do you attribute it to the professor you had, or
I
the
attribute
family?
it too. So I used to want, I wanted to be a lawyer for a long time until I actually worked for a lawyer. And so I spent a long time getting assigned point of view assignments, having to research and things like that. So I think that kind of like left me open mind. I worked for a criminal defense attorney for a couple years, which again is kind of like on the opposite side. And when you work criminal defense, you learn basically that the government lies about almost everything.
I was a criminal defense lawyer for 9 years, actually.
So it's interesting because the first time that I learned that, just going in, and I remember the first like real discovery packet I ever opened up, and I was like, hold up, none of this is lining up. This doesn't. Hold up, they are lying. Like, oh my God, they are lying about everything here. Like, I can prove it over here, And I was lucky. I worked for a really small law firm, so I actually got to sit at the counsel table for a couple
Oh,
trials.
wow.
And so, and we did a really big one for, it was an attempted murder trial, and everything about that case, I could talk about that case. It was a full trial, everything. It was the craziest thing I'd ever seen, what happened. And basically everything the government said happened was a lie. And just knowing how they use this, and then unfortunately, the ways in which you're allowed to defend, especially maybe your client doesn't have a very good defense. I don't know, it's interesting. It's just whatever the government presents, you just view it with skepticism a lot.
That's why I was so shocked. So I was a COVID dissident, I guess you would say. I disagreed with the government's stance on risk COVID restrictions. And I was sort of probably somewhat in the position you are now, where I was on the left and everybody around me was like, and I was in New York City, so you can imagine where it was like the COVID capital of the world. And people were tattling on each other for going outside. And if you didn't wear a mask, you got screamed at on the street. That happened to me many times. I mean, it was crazy. And so I became friends with a lot of COVID dissident people, both on Twitter and in real life, and sometimes both. You know, I'd meet them on Twitter and then meet in real life. And that sort of became my community. And then after October 7th, I couldn't believe what I was hearing. Like, first of all, it was so bloodthirsty. Most people did not know very much about the situation, clearly. It was very clear from what they were saying. But just like calling for Palestinians' blood, just like get them all, they're all terrorists. And then so trusting of both the Israeli and the American government. And I'm like, wait a second, our whole thing has been we know that the government is dishonest and they lie all the time to get you to do certain things or get you to go along with certain things. And you don't realize that that's applying here.
Yeah, I know that was one thing that actually used to kind of piss me off a little bit. I thought, you mean to tell me that do you want to sit here and say, do you think that the government put out a vaccine to murder millions of Americans? You think our government did that? And you don't think that they're above that, which, I mean, we can talk about intent all day long, but at the end of the day, people did die from a lot of things, whether it be, the measures taken, whether it be, deaths of despair, all kinds of things from COVID. Terrible things were inflicted on our people by our government for nefarious reasons, a multitude of them. And yet, when it comes to a foreign government, y'all think they're not capable of doing the same damn thing for their own purposes? Give
Right.
me a freaking break. All
I
right.
know. It's.
It ticks me off because I'm like, so what you say, our government, our people are murderous villains, but the other ones, they're golden? Give me a, and I used to have this one guy that he followed me for a long time, and he would get so mad at me, and he would, because he was very anti-vaccine, and he was, I think he was some kind of investment banker, but he was Jewish, and he hated Netanyahu for his vaccine mandates. This was not even a dumb man by any means, but he used to say, but I need you to support them and him right now. Like,
What?
why? I don't, what? It was so bizarre, you
It's
know?
very bizarre.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly how to explain it. I think there's some anti-Arab racism or anti-Muslim racism, bigotry, you know, and a lot of people just think, okay, this is like 9/11. It's Muslims and there's terrorism happening, so it's like that, and we have to support the Israelis. And then I think just a lot of bigotry. And then most people have not heard the Palestinian side. I mean, our media is saturated
So it's
with
awful,
the
yeah.
side of the Israelis. So I've been encouraging my father to tell his story more. I mean, I can kind of tell it for him, but he grew up under the occupation. He can really tell people what it's like. And no, I mean, nobody I know would put up with that for a day,
Oh,
let
I know,
alone for 50 years.
I know. There's a story. It was this came out in 2022 and. There's a guy. I think he's a journalist now, but he was a Hill staffer for a long time, and I can't think of his name right now. But I remember him sharing it, and yeah, it's kind of one of those things where like you never know where people are going to fall on this, and it doesn't come up that often. But it was a story of a man who was a grocer out of Minnesota. I can't remember the Minneapolis. And 2022, he had moved home to Palestine. He had come here in the 60s, late 60s, built a life here as came here as a refugee. But he was very successful. I think he opened like 12 grocery stores in the Minnesota area. And Amy Klobuchar, she's Minnesota, right?
I think that's right.
Okay, yeah, because she's the senator. So, anyways, he's coming home. He's moved home to the West Bank, lived there for like 2 years, and he's out at his cousin's house. They're playing cards till late in the night, drinking coffee. He's coming home, driving home. It's 3 a.m. and he gets stopped at a checkpoint, and he is told to get out of his car, and he says he can see his house. He's not getting out of his damn car. He's going home. So the IDF soldiers yank him out of the car, and they hog tie, gag him and hog tie him. He's 78 years old. Gag him, hog tie him, drag him to a construction site, leave him face down on the ground in the construction site. He has a heart attack and he dies. And they just leave him there. They just leave. This happened in January 2022. And I was so angry at that at the time, you know, and the IDF, of course, because he had lived in America, because his children were American, they made a big stink out of it. Amy Klobuchar, you know, demanded accountability, but of course nothing happened, you know, nobody did anything. The IDF, you know, Israel said, you know, well, he had prior heart conditions, and so they just kind of, you know, they said, you know, we reprimanded the soldiers involved, but there's no. I was reading an article about him the other day because I was going to make a post, and it said, you know, a Palestinian autopsy. Not an autopsy, but it's got to be a Palestinian autopsy. We've got to make sure we put that little descriptor in there so that you know, maybe take it with a grain of salt, right?
And I mean, that's not even that unusual of a circumstance. That kind
No,
of thing happens all the time, and it
all the
has
time.
for 70 years or more. I remember actually when I was there when I was in 1997, and I haven't been back because things got too bad after the Second Intifada, and my father really didn't want us to go back. He thought it would be too dangerous. And we didn't have, I mean, it was difficult the first time. The Israelis put any Middle Eastern family through a very hard time to get through. You have to wait for hours at the airport. They might not let you in. They search you. Getting through checkpoints is difficult. We had to go through a lot of checkpoints to get to my father's village. So, in any event, I haven't been back since, but I remember my brothers and our cousins somehow made us like fake gun like out of wood. It was just for fun. They were young. They were like, 12 or something. And they went through a checkpoint, and they showed my dad the gun after, and they were all excited, the fake gun. And my dad was so mad, and he was like sweating. He was like, if the soldiers at the checkpoint had seen that, they would have shot all of you immediately. Like, this is not funny. It was, I mean, it stuck with me.
No, and your dad wasn't even being hyperbolic.
No,
Like,
no.
he was.
It was real. He was sweating, like I could see. And he's a very mild-mannered man. He never yells. I think the incident stuck with me because it was the one time he lost it at my brother's. He was like,
It's so frustrating too, you know, again, and it makes me so mad with these children. You know, I don't even know. Every time I think about it, I was watching an interview with an American doctor the other day who had been in doing emergency medicine, and just you could just see it on his face. And I was like, you know, he gets to come home, and it's already like my heart is breaking for him. Like, how do you deal with that? But then I just think, like, what happens to people who have to stay? Like, how do you expect them to ever be normal again? None of this is going to everything's just going to get worse. War just makes everything so much worse.
There will be, I mean, for every child who lost his or her parent or sibling, they're going to be 10 more Hamas terrorists. I mean, Israel just made things way, way
Absolutely.
worse. And everything, this thinking is so short-sighted that you can eradicate Hamas by bombing the shit out of people. Excuse my language.
No. And that was another thing that was very frustrating for me, arguing with conservatives right after 10/7, because I'm like, we did this for 20 years.
Yeah.
Good
I mean,
night.
it might work for like 6 months, but they're going to recruit more people. And as I mentioned, like the people who lost loved ones, they're going to be much more susceptible to recruitment. And that's what happened in 2014. So.
Absolutely. And do we blame them? Of course not. I mean, they're only human. They are human. And so that was the other thing. I'm like, okay, we cannot, when people say we just have to defeat Hamas, you know, that was very frustrating because I'm like, okay, well, this is actually the people that Bibi wanted in power. because for his own purposes. I'm not saying he worked with them. Obviously, that's not true. Hamas—it's an idea. It's a resistance. If they disappear, something else will immediately pop up in its place because we all have an innate human desire to be free. You hear this all the time about Jews have the right to self-determination. And I'm like, okay, well, but we all have the right. Should we not?
No.
To self-determination.
Well, they think, I mean, you hear so much like, well, there are all these other Arab countries. They can go live there. I mean, first of all, that's they want to live on their own land with their own communities and their own families. They would be dispersed. And also, Palestinians do consider themselves a distinct people. A lot of people will say, oh, but there was no state of Palestine before, so there's no such thing. Well, I mean, the people who lived there thought of themselves as a distinct group. My father was actually talking about that. The Jordanians prohibited them by law. The area, for those who don't know, the area was under Jordanian occupation before Israel came to occupy it. They were prohibited by the Jordanians from referring to themselves as Palestinians because the Jordanians were worried they would want self-determination. And actually, when my father was saying when the Israelis took over, they were happy. They thought like maybe it would be better than the Jordanian rule, but then it ended up being way, way worse.
America, obviously, we are a nation of immigrants and whatnot. But my people, we've actually been here a long time. So on my father's side, we came in the 1500s. I can trace
Wow.
back, and my mother's side, the early 1800s. So if you told me like I had to go somewhere else, I would say, what do you mean? Like, oh, well, you're white, you can just go to the UK. No, actually, I can't. This is
That's
my home.
more or less what it would be like. Why don't you just go live in Ontario, Canada? What's the
Exactly.
problem?
Exactly. No, America is my home. America is in my blood. And it's interesting because there's this weird mesh on the left where like the anti-colonialism, anti-imperialism, where it kind of meshes with like the Native American cause, right? Of like settler colonialism. And I feel like it's a little different. So I'm like, I actually don't align with those people because I'm not giving this land back to the Indians either, okay? Because they were here a long time ago. And I know there's going to be people who listen to this who don't agree with me there, but it is what it is. My people have been here for a really long time, and I don't have anywhere else to go. And so, no, we're going to dig in our heels, and I don't want to go live as a refugee in Canada or in the UK or Germany or whatnot. And I don't expect Palestinians to want to go live as a refugee in Saudi Arabia or Egypt or something like that either. This is
Exactly.
their land and
Exactly.
they're fighting for it, damn it. But I will say this, I do not believe in a two-state solution. I just
No.
I don't. I think it's actually the dumbest idea I've ever heard of. I hate the whole thing.
So, first of all, why, and then what do you think the solution is, if there's a solution?
Well, why? Just geographically speaking, it's just dumb. You got Gaza over here, you got the West Bank over here,
And all the settlements in the West Bank now that you'd have to deal with.
the settlements in the West Bank. This whole idea of a Jewish state, I take a lot of issue with as far as America ensuring a Jewish state. Ethno states are obviously antithetical to everything that America was founded on. It would probably be nice if I could be around a bunch of Christians all the time too, and I could like just kind of exclude everybody else. Might make my life a little easier. I don't know if I necessarily want it like that, but we don't always get what we want, and American resources, American money should not be used to further or secure foreign interests. Period, number one, but definitely not foreign interests that are actually contradictory to our founding values, which definitely would be against. They fully reject this idea of preserving, a religious state for someone, for foreigners or even for ourselves. So.
I I totally take your point that it's almost impossible to create a sort of contiguous or in any way meaningful Palestinian state at this point. I also don't see the Israelis giving the Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank citizenship because that would, give them what they call a demographic problem. So there would have to be enormous international pressure, which, yeah.
I came across something today, and I screenshotted it because I found it very interesting. This is a Brookings poll from July of 2013, or excuse me, 2023, July 2023 says. And it said if a two-state solution to the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians were not possible, meaning the West Bank and Gaza had to be under Israeli control indefinitely, which of the following would be closer to your view? And this polled 1,100 Americans identifying as Republican, Democrat, or Independent. And the overwhelming majority of Republicans, Democrats, and Independents said that they would favor Israel's democracy over its Jewishness.
Huh, that's really surprising.
Yeah, it was 64% of Republicans, 80% of Democrats, and 73% of Independents.
I wonder what that poll would be like if it was taken today.
I actually think that most people have no idea what Zionism is. They don't understand at all. When you look at the ADL's definition, when you look at, they really, really dance around the subject. Because I think if you told if the average American knew that we were spending an enormous amount of money, time, resources to ensure and secure a Jewish state for Jews and pretty much only Jews, yeah, you've got your 20% Arabs, but that's it. I think actually most people would say no. They would be opposed to that. They wouldn't like that. And so, and I'm sure that the polling agrees with me, and that's why you see the message very carefully curtailed in such a way.
That's interesting. I mean, we're around such different groups of people that I have a very different impression of what, people think. But because I'm around mostly sort of elite on both the right and the left, city people, and it's just everybody talks about this. Everybody knows something about it. I mean, they don't know as much as they should, I think, to have an opinion, but they certainly know what Zionism is, and they think I'm a terrible person for questioning some of its premises.
So what do you, how do you define Zionism?
That's a good question, and I don't know if I'm actually not sure I have a cohesive definition. I don't. I mean, I think people might agree, might have different definitions. I think what most people mean when they say it is, the Jews are entitled to a state on that strip of land, and they're entitled to a Jewish majority, and to maintain that majority at any cost. That's my interpretation.
Right, I think that is so I define it as that I say the Jews have a blood right to the land of Israel, which is defined in Numbers 34 in the Bible, which typically run it's actually pretty red. It's like the Euphrates or the Jordan River all the way down, I think, to the northern tip of Africa. I actually don't quote me specifically on the geographical, but essentially all of the West Bank, all of Gaza, but it actually extends beyond the West Bank into Syria. But Numbers 34, and they, because God gave that to them. And so I think most dispensationalists would agree with that. But okay, that's fine if you believe that. You're more than welcome to believe that if you want to. I actually don't know what God said. I don't know about God's feelings on that. I think it's pretty much up in the air, but I actually do know pretty well what the US Constitution says about that. And the US Constitution says that we have no business funding and ensuring that because we don't fight religious wars in this country, period. And We don't expend American tax dollars to ensure religious ethno states, period. And that's my position, and that's a hard position. And I pretty much challenge anybody to show me in any American law, US law, or anywhere in our Constitution or in our founding principles or values where you can justify American tax dollars going to towards this cause.
And I mean, to the contrary, George Washington was unequivocal that these kind of entanglements were extremely dangerous, and the United States should make sure we weren't involved in any kind of unequivocal support for any foreign country.
Absolutely. And this is why you see our representatives cling to this two-state solution BS as much as possible, because they absolutely know that there is no justification for what they do. So it's why they cling to this fake idea that somehow we're going to solve all that, we're going to get a two, even though they all know it's never happening. And the problem with Trump was he actually said the quiet part out loud, when he said, Bibi, you don't want to do a two-state solution. And of course he doesn't. And the Likud is very clear on their intentions on that. They want no part of it. This is their land, and they're more than willing to wait, but it doesn't matter. They're going to kick the people off the land.
And that is why this conflict keeps going on and on, despite
And
what you hear from
on
the
and on and on.
media, not
Right.
you,
And
but
you
other people.
will. Right. And so, at the end of the day, all you have to do is look at the settlements. All you have to do is look at the look at how, what transpires. I think, who was it? It was John Mersheimer, I think it was, who he really described perfectly what happens. The Israelis pushing and pushing and pushing until finally they get a response, a big enough response from the Palestinians that they can then enact their own massive over response. And we haven't even gotten into the proportionality of warfare law, which of course is like another whole giant thing that it's like, can we even talk about this? Can we even talk about how disproportionate the response has been? It's been so barbaric. It's maddening,
I know. Well, and people keep saying, Israel has a right to defend itself, and blah blah blah. I mean, I think there's a real question about that, given that
If
they
it defends
put
their
Gaza. Yeah, I mean, they keep Gaza under siege, so they're more or less an occupying power as international law considers it. And so there's a question as to whether they actually have the right to defend themselves against people who are resisting that occupation. But that's a story for another day. Because I do want to talk with you before we have to go about the upcoming election, presidential election, and how you see all of this playing into it. So I actually had a conversation with Michael Tracy recently. Do you know who he is? He's sort of a, yeah, he's very smart and interesting, also an interesting thinker like you. But he was pushing me. So I had been saying I was likely to vote for Trump. I mean, my vote doesn't matter because I live in Washington, D.C., so it's all symbolic. But I was saying I was likely to sort of support Trump over Biden or now Harris, because I want to see conservative Supreme Court justices. I don't want the federal government to expand its power. I want judges who are going to restrain it. And I would say that's sort of the big issue that I see in addition to the Palestinian one. And I just don't see the Democrats being that much better. Michael Tracy was really pushing me on it, citing a lot of evidence that Trump is in the pocket of the sort of Christian Zionists and that he's really going to be very extreme on this subject and may give Israel, basically carte blanche to do whatever it wants. And any kind of restraint they might have been exercising because they're worried about losing US support will be out the window. So I was wondering, what's your take on all of that?
So my take is different. Number one, Trump is not a Christian Zionist, okay? Like Trump is fungible, okay? Trump is basically number one, if you can obviously if you can fund him, he's probably going to do your bidding a little bit. Number two, if you flatter him. So funding then flattering are basically the way to get him to do what you want, right? And so obviously there's a problem if you're pro-Pal, I guess. Miriam Adelson, obviously that the Israel lobby funds both sides. So it's there's something important to know about funding, and this is kind of where I can talk. This is where I'm really comfortable about what the funding does, what it doesn't do, and what it buys. So, are you familiar with Citizens United?
Yes, yeah.
Okay. So you know that Citizens United opened up the floodgates for super PACs. Most people don't actually know what a super PAC is. So a super PAC is not giving money directly to a candidate. You are giving money to a PAC set up in support of a candidate, right? Now, by law, the candidates are not allowed to coordinate with the super PACs. I mean, it does happen, obviously, but something interesting when you're digging through campaign finance, what you kind of learn is that the super PACs are actually kind of, they're a little bit of the workhorses of the campaign system. That's actually, if you want to see the money spent the most efficiently, it is going to be obviously the billionaires getting their max penny worth, right? So Marianne Adelson and obviously Sheldon Adelson, they were the biggest funders for Republicans 2014, 16, 18, and 20, right? Giving hundreds of millions of dollars. They are one issue donors, right? So some background, Sheldon Adelson was a Las Vegas
Casino
hotel
magnet.
casino magnate, right? So that's where he made all his money. Miriam Adelson and Sheldon Adelson was born and raised in America. He's Jewish, but he was born and raised in America. Miriam Adelson was born in Israel. She was a physician, Israeli trained physician. She speaks with even speaks English even to this day with an extremely heavy Hebrew accent. She moved to Vegas with her husband. She was kind of his connection into Israel, right? They were really behind the big push for the Israeli embassy move to the point where they actually, when the embassy moved from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, they went in and bought the old building in Jerusalem where the embassy was. And I believe they built a house in it. So to ensure that nobody could ever move back there, that no other later administration could ever move back. Miriam Madison, after Sheldon Adelson died in 2021, she moved home to Tel Aviv. She doesn't even live in America. Okay, this is so obscene. That we let this woman give in our politics, right? So she lives in Tel Aviv. So the rumor was like, okay, she's somewhere it leaked and that she wanted annexation. She wanted an improvement. Basically, so Trump, he recognized the Golan Heights settlements. I'm mixed on that because, it kind of been settled for like 50 years. I'm not saying it's right. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm not gonna lie. I just don't care that much. I mean, I get it. It kind of feels a little bit settled to me. I feel like a lot of the things that Trump did were really symbolic, but not necessarily that, obviously the embassy move was big, and I'm sure that there are other people who put a lot more importance in it than me, but to my knowledge, no new territory was gained. Either with the settlement or with the recognition of the Golan Heights or with physical territory was no gain. So I see the two big quote unquote accomplishments of Trump as more symbolic. What they really wanted from him was an expansion of the Syrian war, which he didn't give, obviously. Something, a little connection. So, I said my ex-husband was a Green Beret. Well, his teammate was a guy named Joe Kent, who I don't know if you know who Joe Kent was, is.
No.
He ran for Senate, or excuse me, he ran for the House out in Washington. I think he's running again. Joe Kent was actually in my wedding. He's a really good man. Well, his wife, Shannon, was killed in Syria. And when Trump went to meet him at Dover, and he went in and he talked to Joe. And Joe shared the story, said, Trump looked at him and said, what do you think we should do? And Joe shared his Joe had been a he had gone from being a Green Beret to he ended up doing like some kind of CIA crossover. And he's very anti-war now. And he shared his thoughts, and Trump was really touched by Joe, and that's what made him draw down in Syria. And obviously, he had the falling out with John Bolton. He had the falling out with all of his generals because, of course, they wanted to keep our troops in Syria, and they would have happily expanded the war. And then, of course, Trump did what he always does, which is kind of like half-ass everything, like kind of like, oh, I'm pulling out, but kind of trying to please everyone. So that's Trump's biggest downfall, right? He wants to make everybody happy. I don't take I'm not trying to make excuses for him. I wish that he were the anti-war person that I thought he was in 2016,
Yeah.
who I happily voted for. That being said, I don't see him. There was that leak about her wanting to annex the West Bank. She's denied that publicly. He's never said anything about it. Excuse me, to my knowledge, she's only given $5 million so far. She doesn't like Trump. She wasn't
Huh.
happy with him. She wanted Nikki Haley. That's her girl.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Right. She when Nikki Haley dropped out, she flew Nikki Haley on her private plane over to Israel, where she had like the big talk.
So you're basically not extremely concerned that you would make things a lot worse.
No, I actually don't think the good thing about Trump is he's very susceptible to what people think about him. And I've said this since the get-go. If it were Trump supplying all those bombs, the left in this country would have shut this, they would have shut it down. They would have lost their ever-loving minds by day 10, without a doubt. The protests on the college campuses would have been like nothing you'd ever seen. And I think everyone knows that. I think no one knows that more than Bibi,
Yeah.
period.
Yeah.
I don't care what anybody says, they do not want Trump back there.
Yeah.
Bibi and Trump do not like each other. They don't. Trump hates him, and I'm pretty sure the feeling's mutual. I don't see it going that way. I mean, I get Michael's cynicism. I'm not saying that he's I don't think he's fully wrong. I just maybe I and maybe it's a cope from me. I don't know, but
I agree with you that in the end, I don't think it matters that much.
no,
I think they're both going to be more or less the same awful, and nothing will change right now.
the only thing that I can see is that if it's a Republican supplying the bombs, the left is just like Caitlin Johnstone said. Then all of a sudden they remember the genocide is bad again.
Yeah.
You
Yeah.
know?
I think there's a point to be made there. Well,
Yeah.
I've been told we should wrap things up
Okay.
in the interest of time. But I appreciate you coming on. This was such an interesting conversation. It was so
Yeah,
fascinating to
thank
hear
you
your
so much for
views.